Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's live edition of the War Report. I know I have been gone for a couple of weeks, and I hope you still remember me. You know, absence should make the heart grow fonder. So, let's get right into today's show. We've got two guests that have been on the show before. You know them all. And they are from New York, New York City area. Oh, and by the way, I have arrived in Buffalo, New York last night, and officially I have moved to Buffalo, New York from Los Angeles. More about that either later this show or the next show. Let's start with Mark. Welcome back, Mark. This is Dr. Mark Mason.
It's always great to be on the War Report with my soul brother, James Avington Miller.
Well, thank you, Mark. I think that's probably the most kind thing you've ever said to me. Because when we're not on air, you give me... Anyway. Axia?
Yeah.
Did I say that right?
Aixa.
Okay, I'm sorry, Aixa. I do that all the time. I am so messed up. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, Aisha from New York. We have what I think should be a really exciting program for teachers, for parents, for students. These two people have put together something that is incredible. And I'm going to say, Mark, let's you guys start off by saying what the program is, but then I want to go back in terms of how it came about.
Okay. The Bronx History Collaborative is something that, as far as I know, has never been tried before. It is a college course on Bronx history and culture that is being taught simultaneously in two high schools, with the students in the university and the high schools having very similar curriculums, attending one another's courses, participating in concerts and tours together, and breaking down the walls between universities and public schools, and at the same time unleashing new strategies for pedagogy that excite students in both places and challenge the increasingly test-driven and standardized approach to curriculum taking place in both of these areas.
That's incredible. Just think about what he just said, folks. That is incredible. I see, will you go next?
Yeah. So I guess to describe it a little further, for me, as the high school teacher, building that bridge to what people love to call a college, you know, and career preparation, there really needs to be something called relevance. It has to be relevant to the kids. And it has to be something that's powerful enough to drive them, to motivate them, to step out of their comfort zones and start to learn a little bit about what it's like to be in college authentically, by actually visiting the college, by actually listening to a professor and interacting with college students, as opposed to claiming that some outsider standards are college prep, to actually prep them for college by teaching, you know, how to write a paper, how to read books, how to use multiple sources, how to use oral histories and memoirs and different types of materials to actually develop a thesis and write a paper.
Yeah. What AIXA is doing is the much more difficult, challenging, and important part of this, because she is inventing a style of pedagogy that challenges everything that's been coming down from the state and federal governments and the powerful foundations about how you teach inner city kids. She has taken this opportunity to reinvent how to reach them. And it's an incredibly exciting thing to see. What I have had to do is deal with the bureaucracy of a university which has increasingly walled itself off from the working class immigrant community surrounding it. So each of us have different kinds of challenges when we come together here. And I think as we talk about this, it'll all be clear. But let me talk a little bit about how this started, because the story is, this all started with a series of awful racial incidents at Fordham last fall, which dramatized not only, you know, entrenched racism in the student population, but the contempt some of the students had for the Bronx community in which Fordham, Rose Hill campus is located. And a group of students came to me and said, "Dr. Nason, we not only need educational activities aimed at helping students confront racism in their own lives, we have to confront their paternalistic and contemptuous attitudes towards the people and cultures of the Bronx, and we want you to teach a new course in the Bronx." So on the spot, with the help of the students, with the help of Bronx community groups and local scholars, I created this new course called The Bronx, Immigration, Race, and Culture, which had its inaugural teaching this fall. Now, one of the things I wanted in this course was to get the students out into the neighborhood in different ways than community service, which is the often promotes paternalistic activities. I wanted them to experience the Bronx so that they were the recipients of the cultural vitality of the community, and in a way different that was normal. And over the summer, I had some conversations with people in something called consortium schools in New York City. There are 30 schools who have been given partial exemption from the test requirements for graduation, and therefore have more opportunity to do creative instruction. And they suggested that I hold workshops on Bronx history and culture for teachers. And I did that this summer. And I found two amazing teachers who were willing to do something that had never been tried before: teach courses in Bronx history and Bronx memoir simultaneously with my course. One of them, and both are at these consortium schools. One of them, Talia Sinkinson, is at Community School for Social Justice. And Aixa, who I've worked with before, is at Fannie Lou Hamer Freedom High School. And what I rapidly saw was that this experience was going to bridge the university gates and put my students in the community in ways which had never done before. And what I had to do, the hardest thing that I had to do, is make sure my university didn't stand in the way, that the high school students would be welcome on the campus whenever they came, whether it was for a concert, for a tour, for sitting in on classes, for cultural events. I had to make sure that everybody in the institution welcomed them, and also motivate my students to take risks in working in the schools in ways where, you know, they were going to have to really learn to interact with very bright, very motivated, and also occasionally pretty confrontational kids who were going to be really challenging who they were. So my job, again, was not so much pedagogical in terms of designing a course, because my students helped me do that, but keeping the university gates open and getting my students out into these schools in ways where they would be stretched in ways they never had before.
Let me interject something here, Mark. You said, because I remember those incidents last fall, okay? If you and I, let's hark back to 1968, April.
Mm.
You know where I'm going. The King assassination, and then the riots. I hate the word riots, but anyway, the riots that took place.
Right.
But remember on a college campus, the black students that were on the few urban campuses around the country demanded three things at least, and that were they wanted more black students, they wanted black professors, and they wanted courses that was relevant to the black experience.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to connect the dots from April 68 to what happened here last fall in New York in terms of the outward display of racism on campus and the students and faculty getting upset with this and the outcome being another sort of like African American studies part two.
Yeah.
Think about what I just said, Mark.
No, I absolutely agree with you because Aixa knows our universities are becoming more and our elite universities more and more closed, more and more expensive, more and more with huge race and class barriers separating them from the bulk of young people in the society. And at a, and this is happening at a time when our public schools are being dumbed down by tests and zero tolerance discipline. So this kind of initiative has a way to take on both of those, both the increasing elitism of the university and the sterility and brutality of the policies being directed at our inner city, you know, and working class students.
It came out of the racial incidents that took place there, just like the racial incidents that have taken place all across the country. What I'm trying to get at in terms of our profession, African-American studies, that you and I were students when all of this took place
mm-hmm.
back then, gave rise to the African-American studies movement on campuses.
Yep.
It was a direct one-to-one correlation between what took place in 68 and historically, too, but it's the 68 uprising and the many uprising you had on your campus last fall.
Mm-hmm.
I just see those two as being, God, such a mirror image of each other so many 40s, 50 years later in time.
Mm. Well, you know, what I hope is that...
Just think about it. I don't want to derail you, but just think about that. Let's go back to what you were saying in terms of bringing the history together. And then now the mechanics.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, when we started, I said, this is something, if it works well, and let me tell you, you could not have two more brilliant teachers than Aixa Rodriguez and Talia Sinkinson. They are brilliant intellectuals as well as deeply devoted to the young people. If this works and every sign shows that good things are happening, this is a model that should be imitated all around the country. Universities becoming insular and ethnocentric and is something that's happening all over. Our public schools being, rendered stale by top-down curricular and disciplinary strategies. But the genius is going to, you know, I'll be honest with you. Aixa is the genius here because she has to figure out how to take on everything that's been happening in public schools, which she's experienced in many other schools, and reinvent it. So I would love for her to explain what she has been doing, because I'll tell you, quite frankly, it's much harder than what I've had to do.
Go.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mark. Should I explain?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because it, in very concrete terms, because if we want people to do this, they really ought to know what they're getting into.
This is true.
Right.
For real. Well, I guess the clearest way to me explain is I took your syllabus. I took your main themes and the main questions that you gave, those essential questions, and then I broke it down with the materials you chose, and I tried to see what would be relevant to the kids and what would be accessible to the kids. I'm teaching 11th and 12th grade, so I understood that there would be certain skills that they should already have, because they had done the beginning of their portfolios at this school, so they were familiar with a lot of things. But I knew that they would come with certain deficits. So not only was I introducing the books and the journals and the articles, but I was also assessing what level they came in at. And this is the real truth about high school in many inner city, I hate that word, inner city, and many schools in areas that are affected by lots of, you know, other issues, there are not always... there's not a guarantee that they're all the kids come in at the same grade level, reading level, writing level. So the instruction needs to be flexible, and you need to assess at the beginning. How do I fold in all the writing instruction and all the grammar instruction, all the guidance for that, at the same time that I'm trying to get all the content through, and at the same time being at a consortium school? Am I getting the kids ready for what we call masteries, the PBATs, it's called in other schools? Our school does not use Regents exams. We create portfolios. So out of every single class, these kids must come away with a piece that would allow them to graduate on time. And some of the kids need more than one. So I have a variety of kids in my class that need different pieces for their portfolio. So to create my curriculum, I had to do something that my school needed, do something that the kids needed, the skills that they needed, and get the content and information and the concepts that you had created in your syllabus, and kind of combine them all. And try to do this in the school week with all the obstacles and challenges and hoops and that you need to go through to actually teach in a school like this, which is you know, a different type of thing. I don't see the kids Monday through Friday. I see the kids three times a week. My classes are 2 hours long on Mondays and Wednesdays and Tuesdays and Thursdays, and Fridays they're an hour long, hour and 15 minutes long. So I have to adjust my teaching and the materials and the activities based on the length and the stamina of the kids. And since I don't see them every day, I have to trust that they're doing their work because I can't check them the next day. So there are real life challenges to it, but there's also the reality that if you're going to teach a course for high schoolers, you are preparing them for what they're going to encounter in college. So you have to build them from where you get them to where you want them to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I want to also say something that I have seen. Aixa brought a group of around 20 of her students to Fordham to have a joint class with me where I explained the origins of the course, explained how immigration and cultural mixture was responsible for the extraordinary musical creativity of the Bronx from the 1940s through the present, and why they should start looking at the communities they live in with pride, because there's this incredible history that's literally inspired the world. But after that, which they actually listened to with great attention, and they're sitting in an auditorium side by side with my students, we did an oral history interview with Aixa, to show them how an oral history is done. And we did this after I explained how everything that we learned about immigration and musical creativity came from the oral histories we did with the Bronx African American History Project. So this was going to be a sample interview. We're sitting on stage in front of about 60 students. So I start out with some sample questions. Then I had the students do the questioning, one student from Fordham, one student from Fannie Lou Hamer, back and forth. And the interview was amazing. It was a really powerful, moving interview. And each group asked better questions with the other there than they would have done separately. The Fannie Lou Hamer students pushed my students to be more thoughtful than they would have been, and vice versa. And it was such a powerful day that my students came up to me and said, Dr. Nason, we want to interview you. So the chemistry of the two in that moment seemed to work. Also, I sent two of my very best students down to Aix's class to work with them. And they were at first shaken up by what they confronted, that, you know, the kids were skeptical of their presence, not necessarily immediately receptive, but over time they got into it in a really powerful way, and I think began to make some connections. And it also sounds like for Aix's students, having college students with them in the classroom on a regular basis, you know, was sort of demystifying college for them in ways which would make it more accessible. So what I was beginning to see, you know, is, and we have several other events coming up where they're coming to Fordham for a concert, for a meeting with young people from Berlin, for a class discussion, is that both groups are elevated by the interaction. Everybody has to go the extra mile and get out of their comfort zone, you know. But, hey, isn't that what education is supposed to do?
Exactly.
Get you out of your comfort zone. But, you know, one of the things, I mean, again, Aixa is also creating things, you know, maybe she used my syllabus, but she has gone out in her own. See, the other thing here is, we're using the Bronx as a resource. There's not only resistance from my students who, you know, they're living in a closed campus where you never have to even leave the campus to get to Manhattan because they have a bus service called the Ram Van. Do you know, listen to this, Aixa. You know Ariana, you know, who's working in your class. She did this amazing walking photo exhibit of the Grand Concourse. Do you know that was the first time she had ever been on the Grand Concourse in 3 years?
She was telling me this. And the
I mean, that these kids
to
are totally
there,
insulated.
What she was doing.
Yeah. And it's crazy, but that's what because of how Fordham approached socializing these students. But it's also that Aix's students are somewhat resistant because they're predisposed to see the Bronx negatively. So, you know, getting them to claim it, there are also obstacles there. So, again, we're working to, you know, we're going against the grain of everything going on in public and higher education here, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what makes it exciting, but it ain't easy.
It is definitely not easy. But go ahead, Aixa.
Well, tell me about it. It's been interesting to see how it works because, you know, when things happen, you take advantage of the opportunity, but all the pieces may not be there perfectly. The children in my classroom were placed into my class. They didn't opt for it, so they didn't know what they were getting into. And so when you don't know what you're taking and you have a schema from your previous classes that, you know, they, and it conflicts with what you expected, there is that cognitive dissonance. Like, what is this class? What is this class about? You know, I need to get my mastery and graduate. I need to just do my project and go. And very similar to how kids in high school, regular high schools who take Regents exams, all they care about is passing the test. They forget that there's learning that happens before that. And that's a problem. That's why it's a problem to have testing as an exit requirement, because it takes away the value of the actual work. But it's a very similar attitude. They just want to know what they need to get out. And it's been a weird thing for them to realize that, no, you learning. You're going to have to learn, and you're going to prove to me this. There are some kids who've complained about simple things and other kids who just didn't get it. I gave out a little mini survey in the warm-up. I asked them what streets are near where you live, because I wanted to know general in the class who lived near each other and what streets they were next to, if they knew the history of it. And I figured asking that question was a simple enough task that you can do in 5 minutes. Kids resisted that and complained and acted out because of that. And what they discovered later on was that I had a book that came from the Bronx Historical Society that I'm planning a little game afterwards when we finish this unit about the history of each of these streets. And the book is called The History in Asphalt, which is all the background of each of the street names. And I needed that info from them, and this questions that they've never had to deal with, talking about locations and things that they had no idea that existed. And a lot of the kids got kind of at first shocked, then over time, oh my God, Jimmy Owens, he lives near my cousin. He lived near, and they're starting to realize when they're reading the book, Miss, this is about this neighborhood. And I'm sitting there going, did I not say this day one? But what it was is that putting the Bronx centering the Bronx as valuable enough to study and relevant enough for them to use to actually create a document and graduate with this, this was shocking to them. What is the Bronx? Who cares about the Bronx? Everybody tells me to move out. And that was things a kid said to me.
But you know what? I'll bet people would say that about the east side of Buffalo, right?
Yep.
Yes.
You know, or anyone, you know, North Philadelphia. This is all over the country. You have these young people who have, they're not predisposed to look positively in where they live. You know, and the charter schools all describe the neighborhoods as toxic. It's very interesting that in all my years of the Bronx African American History Project, no charter school has ever invited me in, because their whole approach is based on the neighborhoods are toxic and you have to adopt to succeed in America the culture of the middle class, upper middle class teachers coming in. So this is all very new. And my students, they don't know. They keep saying, I've never had a teacher like Dr. Nason. You never know what the hell's going to happen here. You never know who's going to come in. You're never going to know where you're asked to go. There's no predictable curriculum. There's no predictable tests.
Mark, I say that about you all the time.
Right. Yeah, so nobody knows what the hell is going to go on, but some of my students are rising to the occasion. I am really proud of Ariana and Margaret, who have gone down to work, you know, at IEEX's class, and every time I ask for volunteers, people volunteer. We had this amazing former rapper, Darney Caborn Roberts, who's doing incredible anti-violence work in the Bronx. He came to the class, and 9 of my students signed up to want to volunteer with him. So there are these good things happening, but it's like everything is very close to chaos. That's how I would describe it. Everything is on the verge of spiraling out of control because it's all so new. And you have to, but on the other hand, compared to what what else is being done, this is a breath of fresh air. But you
let
need...
Me ask a,
yeah.
Let me ask the question of to both of you. Mark, starting with you, on your campus, what has been the reaction, if any, of your colleagues and the administration? And the, what's behind this question is, if we're going to try and spread this concept of pedagogy beyond just Fordham and beyond just the two high schools that you're working with, we want to take it to different districts, different universities, different cities, et cetera. How has your individual campuses been reactive to this? And a little background here. Mark, you remember when African-American studies came on the scene?
Mm-hmm.
There was hostility on the two campuses that I taught. There was hostility on the faculty almost unanimously. Well, also, the faculties were pretty much 98% white. And hence, this notion of African-American studies, it wasn't a discipline, it wasn't scientific, it wasn't academic, it was garbage, and hence, no one was supportive of it. So I can imagine doing what you're doing and how revolutionary it is. The question for me is, let's flash forward from 68, 69, 70, 71, 72 to where we are now in terms of the receptivity on your campus and what it possibly would be on other campuses. And I hate you
okay.
on your campus. I
here, that's a great question. There is no hostility towards it whatsoever, but there is no rush or even evidence that anybody wants to imitate it. The Public Affairs Office of Fordham loves it. It gives, you know, they publicize everything I do, the walking tour, the when the high school students came to Fordham, they love it. It's great press for Fordham. But has any has any faculty come up to me and said, Mark, I would like to do something comparable? No. And, you know, we have a significant number of faculty of color on at Fordham now and who know about what's going on. But here's the deal. The concept of professionalism in academia is so stifling and so much part of the socialization of scholars and, you know, and what you need to do to get hired, promoted, tenured, that something like I'm doing is not something that they ever imagined. And so, you know, you need what you're going to need to have on every campus is a professor who is committed to breaking through the concepts of professionalism that guide professional advancement at those universities.
Let me emphasize something you just said. When I was invited to come to UCLA, this is 1972, the whole faculty that I mentioned was like 98% white, and the student body damn near the same thing. But there had been a couple of shootings. There had been two people got shot, I think. Two students died, and it was a power play sort of thing. So the administration was eager to come up with something to show that they were supportive of bringing in more black students, black faculty, and et cetera. And so they had started the African-American Studies program against the will of the entire faculty, our faculty senate. And they went the wrong direction to start with. And so when they invited me, the sociology department recruited me. And then the faculty, the administration found out about my background. They got involved in the process of recruiting me. And I ended up turning down everyone that made offers to me until I got to the executive vice chancellor on campus. And something that you just said, Mark, was the bottom line of my interview with him, the recruitment. He said, I said to him, I said, you know, the sociology department does not support me getting involved in what's going on here on campus as it relates to the African-American studies, involved with students, blah, blah. And their thing is, they're breaking me in a tenure-track position on their dime. And so I'm expected to do all those things that you just said, Mark, to research, bring money in, publish, the whole nine yards. The executive vice chancellor looked at me and he said, on this campus, I am the first and last word on tenure. If you help save our program, the African American Studies program, you will get tenure. That was the attitude then, and for what you are saying now, that's the attitude now. The receptivity of what you're doing and the prospect of spreading this to all 50 states is going to be a super challenge.
Yeah.
It has to be done. Let's go back to Aisha. We didn't get her in on what's happening
right.
in terms of receptivity from her.
Well, I think that in terms of the administration, once they heard someone mention at the school principals, the consortium principals meeting, I think it was Avram who mentioned what was happening, the idea of it, they were eager to get someone to do it. They wanted to be involved. But they didn't have anybody to teach it. Everybody else was promised to another course. I came on board as a leave replacement, and my background is ESL. Because of this, it was a good fit because I have some English language learners in my classroom. My class counts for them as a course for ESL because obviously the methodology that I'm using to get them to learn to write is based on ESL strategies, which work for anybody, but they get that credit for that. So they were very eager to get it started. It was a rough patch in the beginning. We struggled to order the books, and eventually they came towards the end of September. So I had to use, you know, some unit stuff that Mark had on his journals and stuff that he had assigned, and I put the sequence of the material in a slightly different way because I needed to adjust for the lack of materials. And, you know, the school is small. And when you're in a small school in a small building, not everybody gets their own classroom. So I'm in a classroom that is meant for art and is currently being used to do a great thing about, I guess you call it the maker classes, where they're learning circuitry, they're learning art, they're learning design, and all this stuff with a co-teacher, Ed, who's in there. And it's not really conducive for what I do because it's set up for what he does. So I'm adjusting not having a whiteboard. We have some issues with the smart boards, and I really didn't have anywhere to even write and do my lesson. So there's a lot more prep, and at the same time, I'm adjusting to a different school culture. So I'm trying to teach a course that I'm building the plane while flying it,
mm-hmm.
trying to be flexible with students who had never done something like this before, and trying to install routines on a constant changing thing. So it's been a little bit bumpy at the beginning, but it was welcomed by the administration. But because there was nothing concrete on paper before they even started, there were no unit plans, there was not a curriculum guide, there wasn't any of that. And there will be, because I'm writing it now. By the end of this, we'll have all the materials, we'll have sample essays, we'll have everything that any person who would want to do this could actually look at. They'll see a baseline writing sample from, you know, high level, medium level, low level, students with disabilities, English language learners. They'll see a sample from each one of those types of kids, the first sample, the second sample, and the third sample. They'll see draft writings. They'll see the evidence of how the kids grow and develop their writing skills, and I'll have the evidence, which would be great. But in the beginning, it was like, what is your class about? There's a lot of people who came up to me and offered all these suggestions, and well-meaning, but, you know, problem is that they had no idea what the course was about. And I was like, yeah, it's Bronx memoir, but understand that it's oral history. There's a history element. There's a lot of other things that are embedded in this in order for the kids to get their mastery. So it's the name is a misnomer, Bronx Memoir. I think it should be renamed something in my school, in my school in particular. But that was the name that it was labeled for the kids to get their credit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the name needs to reflect exactly what it is, and the kids need to know ahead of time what they're getting into. And at a recent reflection meeting that we had, one of the questions that was brought up was, did the kids have a choice when they came inside, when they got into the course? And then, of course, it was admitted, no, they didn't, because we started this real late in the game, and the kids didn't know what they were getting into. So they all got placed in the course, and, you know, slowly it's dawning on them that it is kind of interesting. I am getting better reception over time, but I only see them 3 times a week. So what other teachers get after being with the kids for several weeks, it's taking me much longer because I don't see them every day.
Hmm.
You know, so I would prefer to teach this class every single day for shorter amounts of time, because then I can break things down for the kids and be a lot more hands-on with them, I think. But that's just my opinion. Otherwise, kids are getting it. It's getting there.
Yeah, finish your sentence. Most of my audience, as you already know, since you're part of the audience, teachers from pre-K to up to university, from each of your perspectives, what's the message we need to send out to our K through 12 teachers about the incredible important significance of this? And let me give you a little bit background. When I was here in Buffalo, July and August, I went to a town hall meeting, and it was given by, I think, the Northwest Charter Association, and they got a young man here in Buffalo who had grew up here but gone away to college, had been away, I think he said, 14 years, and he came back, and he wants to help revitalize his city, and particularly the public education system here. And what he was doing, he was dogging public education here, and he was trying to promote the charter schools here. And one of his leading attacks was on the teachers. Buffalo, like most urban school districts, teachers are predominantly white. Here, it's 80% white students, 80% students of color, an inverted relationship. And he was talking about how the problem of kids not learning, the education gap, and et cetera, could be in part attributed to the white teachers. They don't care about black kids. They don't care about, they see us in stereotypical terms, and on and on and on. Yes, it was, and I'm sitting there, right? I'm sitting there, and
Lord.
I want to jump up and, you know, chew him a new, I've been away from the show for a couple of weeks. I'm trying to be tame and timid today. But anyway, given what you guys are doing, I see this from the very beginning. Mark, you and I have talked about this before, that you got to break down barriers, stereotypes, not just between, say, the college students and the high school students, but you also have to break down these barriers between the teachers. And actually, you're about to pop a cork over there. What do you want to say?
Lord, I can't believe he said that. I mean, I've had a couple of conversations just recently regarding this whole issue, because I had some awesome white teachers who kicked my ass on the daily. I'm sorry I said that word, but yeah. And they were amazing in junior high school, who got us there in, like, eighth grade at 7:30 in the morning and had us, like, drilling, you know, vocabulary words and had us doing amazing things. But these people cared. These people were there for years. They lived in the community or close enough.
Mm.
Okay, so, I mean, I know that there's a whole issue with the push out of teachers of color, due to programs like Teach for America and Near Teaching Fellows, I know that there's a purposeful recruitment of outsider people because they leave and they don't get invested in the pension. So they don't have babies and stay here. And so it's much cheaper for the state to pay for a master's for someone from Pennsylvania who will leave more than likely within 10 years. Okay, or before, actually.
Okay.
I understand all that stuff behind there. I think the conversation needs to be not motivating children by denigrating their community. That's
yeah. Okay.
So that goes for black teachers, Hispanic teachers, white teachers. If you denigrate the community, whatever color you are in,
I agree. Here's my suggestion. In Buffalo, find two great high school teachers and one bold college professor to do a community history course at the university in coordination with the two high school teachers. Use this model and make it work. Call it the Buffalo History Collaborative. By January, IHCSA will have a great curriculum guide that deals with all these issues, and I have my course syllabus. We will work with anybody who wants to do that. Make it happen in Buffalo. It would work perfectly and address all these issues.
Mark, why do you think I'm back here to live for a year to three?
I know.
You know exactly
Buffalo is
what I'm,
zero
and what I'm planning on doing and why I was asked to come back. But yes, what you and Aisha are doing part of what I'm going to do.
That would be fabulous to hear that it grows.
Yeah. James, I'm going to have to get off because my phone is dying. Okay?
Okay. Well, Aisha, let me finish with you then. I won't say what I'm doing in any detail on this show, but one of the things I will be doing very, very, very soon, I will be giving either town hall or other talks about something that's coming around the country called urban education studies. It's at the master's level. And what's happening is universities and colleges are creating almost an equivalent to the black studies programs of the 60s, the 70s, and what have you. And they're calling it urban education study program, and they're pretty much designed for white female teachers and how to teach, quote, in their inner city schools.
What?
I'm working on that. I'm also working on some other things here, but the whole notion here is that what I think I want people to come to understand now is when you get Teach for America, when you get the charter schools, when you get the corporate reformers, and et cetera, when they start saying how part of the reason that urban students, quote, students of color are not achieving and et cetera is because of their white teachers or teachers, period, what I think is happening, of course, is it's a wedge issue. In politics, you would call it a wedge issue. It's seeking to drive a wedge between the parents and the teachers, between the students and the teachers. And it's the same wedge that they've been trying to drive between the unions and the community, the unions and the teaching profession, and et cetera. So the old divide and conquer. And it's just another instrument that they've come up with to say that a large part of why urban students are not getting it done is because they got white teachers who they don't care about them. So I'm ready to discuss
that in depth. I would say that it's very simplistic of an excuse. You're right, they're making it a very wedge issue. I have had conversations with people who've come to me with that same attitude, and then I ask them, do you know in New York State what the CFE is? And they're like, what? I said, give me your phone. And I've done this in bars. And I've had them type in the name of their school where they went to junior high school. And they've come away with a different attitude, understanding that the schools have been systematically and purposely, just like redlining, underfunded on purpose. So you end up having these schools that are owed $1 million or more, and those could have been librarians, that could have been teachers, full-time real art programs, actual science labs, new social studies books that weren't outdated. Millions of dollars owed to a local school is a real deficit. And you could blame the teachers all they want, but I have gotten over, you know, over $40,000 worth of things via donors' choose. And I've had to beg for the things that I've used to make my kids learn. And I shouldn't have to. That's something that I already pay taxes for that. So maybe there are a vast amount of young teachers who don't stay, don't care, and leave. This is true. But that doesn't explain decades and decades of neglect and underfunding, purposeful to particular neighborhoods. And it also does not explain why there are programs like receivership, like the renewal program
right.
in New York
City.
We
have to stop, Aisha.
Yeah.
My time is up. Folks, I am going to continue with this subject maybe even next week. I plan to do a show on this question of white teachers versus black students. People don't like to talk about race, but it's reality, and we're going to deal with it here on War Report. With that, I'm going to say I missed you guys. I was off doing some things that I couldn't do without, well, I wanted to say I couldn't be on the show and do the things that I need to do in order to move here. So I'm back, and I hope you guys are back with me. See you next week. Thanks, everyone.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.